We should do some yoga. What do you guys think about a podcast studio where we're all like...
No?
No?
No.
I feel like we could be more relaxed. Hello and welcome to the next episode of the It Depends podcast. Today we're talking about open source. I'm Daniel Pritchett.
Hey, this is Dave Mahundro, Mo. Hi. Hey, Jesse.
Hey.
Today's episode, open source. We're going to talk about what open source is, how it works, why it's important, what it means to us at work, and what it might mean to you. And there we go. I'm going to start out with what is open source. And Jesse, why don't you tell us what you think open source is?
Put me on the spot.
Yes, yes.
Open source is, you know, source code that is freely available. And freely is not really the right word to use because they come with various licenses which tell you what you can and can't do with that source code.
Okay.
But a lot of people package them up in ways that basically makes it free to, you know, build your own app on top of, you know, what other people have spent their time doing.
Okay. Mo, would you give us some historical context on open source?
I was going to say, talking free, we could, I don't even know if we want to get down into the rabbit hole of free and open source.
Ooh, yeah.
Or acronym FOSS, or just something that you have to pay for that also happens to be open source.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I'm not a lawyer, the disclaimer there, but it's like, I think that, you know, there's the idea that there are people out there who feels very strongly about code being both open and free.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are various types of licenses out there, though, where it's if you use it for open and can keep all of your code open as well, then you can use it. But if you use it for anything commercial or if it stays private, then you have to pay for it.
Is okay.
It a Afero? AGPL? Yes. Something like that?
Let's get into the various flavors of licensing a little bit later. So yeah, we've been doing a lot of Windows work lately. I have anyway, and Windows has had a big part in the saga of open source in the last few decades. Not necessarily as protagonist, but they're there, right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Microsoft's That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, Microsoft historically, you know, they I think they have been giving to open source mm-hmm. for a very long time, right? Like I believe they have contributors to a lot of the really popular open source libraries. Like I believe there's some Linux developers that Microsoft either supports or they work at Microsoft and also commit to
oh, yeah.
to the core. I mean, they've been committing to multiple open source technologies that they build mm-hmm. things on for you know, a long time. I would say, I'd probably say decades.
Yeah. I'd say the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a major shift in like Microsoft's overall business yeah. strategy. And you could look at, say, Scott Hanselman. He's one of the biggest Absolutely. Bloggers and podcasters in the Microsoft space. And he personally seems to be involved in a lot of open sourcing right. efforts.
Yeah, even Azure, you know, their cloud stuff that they're charging you for these days, they've got a lot of the newer ones. The actual tech stack itself is open source, and you can host it on your own
mm-hmm.
your own terms. And so, it and .NET, of course, .NET Core is their new open source version of .NET, basically.
Right.
And so they've got that going on, and yeah, it's been an interesting shift because I've been a Microsoft developer for a long time, mm-hmm. and when I started, that wasn't the case. And it gets better every year with them trying to open source and be better community members just to the programming community in general.
I don't remember the exact quote, but before, I feel like it may have been Ballmer, but, you know, wanting to destroy open source.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it has shifted dramatically for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, back when the cash cow was Windows and Office on the desktop,
right?
Then Linux was viewed as an existential threat. So we can't have open source mm-hmm. going over and taking things over. But then suddenly, I mean, heck, I think Bill Gates' book back in the 90s wasn't super big on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And we had that in my house, the book. So obviously the internet was not able to be swept away by a novel. But anyway, so it's here, and Linux is spread. It's not necessarily taken over the Office desktop. That's still kind of a Microsoft stronghold or a Windows stronghold. But at the same time, other form factors, the rise of tablets and smartphones are really just eating away at the...
Yeah, that's probably a discussion for another time, but I do feel like there's a huge class of people that will just never really log onto a computer in their day in,
right,
their
right.
day in, day out. They just have their their tablets or their phones, and that's that is their primary computer. It does everything that they need it to do, and they never have to log on to, quote, real computers. And unlike us, so, we're coding away, slaving away on keyboards every day, all day.
Funny programming anecdote to me, anyway, on that note, I saw a link in a company's Slack the other day about Unix beards. It was the idea of Unix hackers having big beards, right? And the article was silly. It was mostly, it was frivolous. But the intro mentioned the history of Unix as an operating system made by Bell or AT&T or whomever back in the 70s. And it is really the grandfather of most all the open source operating systems you have out there nowadays. And the article made the point that Unix is an ancestor of iOS, which I guess if you'd asked me, I could have traced the lineage from iOS back to NextStep and BSD and all that stuff to get to Unix, but I never really thought about it that way. Because as a developer who's been playing with Unix or Linux since the 90s, Unix doesn't really need an introduction to me. Like, I know it, I like it, I'd love to have more of it in my work life, right? But hearing that used as a way to connect to regular lay people, I guess, like, did you know that you've got Unix in your pocket right now?
There's so many people, I mean, even, you know, if they're using a MacBook or an iMac or something like that, what percentage of users of those devices actually know that, oh, actually, this is running on, it's a Unix system, to quote Jurassic Park.
I would say most people do not know that. And I'd also say they probably don't care.
Yeah, but you're right. Yeah.
But the truth is, going back to sort of the topic, is that iOS and MacBooks and everything are built on Unix, which is open source technology.
Right.
Like, we wouldn't be where we're at today without, like, the Unix core and all the open source bits. I mean, if you were to shell into an iPhone or open your MacBook and open up the terminal, most of the tools you're going to use every day developing for it have been open source and have been in the kernels and contributed by hundreds of people over you know, many years. And so that's how software's got as good as it is today, building on the backs of everyone else's small contributions.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Microsoft wanting to kill open source because it's threatening their cash cow, but there's, if I guess you could say, evolutionary advantages to having something that is public, it's been read and improved by thousands of people, it's battle tested for decades, and it doesn't necessarily have the same profit motives controlling it. So at a low enough level, when you get to the plumbing of the internet or operating systems or computers, it's really hard to just say, hire 1,000 people, throw tens of millions of dollars at them, and expect them to beat the open source go-to for something. Not to say that everything's good for open source. Like, you guys maybe want to give an example of an arena where open source is unlikely to be anywhere close to the forefront?
Games would be one.
Okay.
I mean, interesting, yeah.
You know, but it's sort of, I say that because the most popular game engine is actually Unreal, which you can get the source for. So it's, they're also trending that way just because, like you said, they finally kind of realized that their business model for open source might be, oh, we'll continue making our engine like we always have, but then we'll just end up selling like profit sharing or licenses that way, but they'll leave it open source because they'll be able to pull in more things from the community when they figure out kind of where the community is going. Games are evolving really quickly, and it lets people get in there and sort of hack away on it, and then they get the benefit of the community members wanting to help out the core project for their next version. I mean, they basically get, you know, free labor or at least free ideas from the community to implement in their system. But the actual, like, games themselves are generally almost never open source. Like, I don't really know very many, like, you know, you might see a Flappy Bird clone open source on GitHub that someone did for fun, but, you know, you're not going to find, you know, the iOS Mario game. It's not going to be open source anytime soon.
Right.
There's no AAA titles out
there. Yeah, exactly. Like, no one's putting the actual titles out there.
I love the Unreal example of how they folded open source into their business model over time. Like, I don't remember the details exactly, but I think you start decades ago with a first-person shooter called Unreal. Eventually, and you know, every time they release a new edition, maybe they sell hundreds of thousands of copies. I don't know. It's enough to keep the business running, but eventually they start licensing out their engine to other people. So maybe somebody who doesn't have that core team of experienced, great developers to make their own engine can take this starting point, get good graphics, good physics, etc., maybe decent net code, and just slap in their own gameplay and graphics. And so suddenly they're licensing that out 15 ways, and eventually the profits there exceed maybe the profits of actually making and selling the Unreal game.
Yeah, and I think it kind of goes back to Microsoft as well with their cloud technologies, where, you know, before they sort of didn't really do too much with open source, but open sourcing, it really doesn't hurt them in any way. They're making their money different ways. And so they've evolved their business model to, you know, hey, we'll host it for you and we'll make things really nice and easy for you so you don't have to do it. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it's using the same technology that you can use yourself most of the time. And so, and it's not necessarily that we don't have the people that could do it. Going back to like your game example, they could create an engine probably, but it doesn't make sense to.
Yeah, lowers the barrier to entry.
Just building. Yeah, exactly. If, like, you could pay, you know, you're going to pay them 5% of your profits or something like that. Right. But like that 5%, could you build an engine as sophisticated as that in that time frame? And as long as that answer is no, Unreal's as an engine is going to continue to be popular.
If you're not a big studio with the bankroll to throw a couple million at making your own engine up front, the idea of paying nothing and then eventually paying 5% of profits later is good.
Well, the other thing too, just on that note, is development and programming in general are so complicated that when the code is out there, people can learn on it, and then they can iterate from it. And so you don't have to start from scratch every time.
Yeah, you don't make the mistakes, and you don't... You
know. I mean, you like the Unreal, as an example there, it's helped build new ways to sort of think about it. And so there's, you know, in the web world, I mean, you can sort of actually look at web frameworks from when Rails entered the scene. The same thing happens in hardware.
Yeah.
Not in terms of the openness, but you know, when the first iPhone was announced, the way the Android mockups looked before and after it was announced were drastic. It's just people see it and like, that's a totally different way. Rails with MVC and, you know, convention over configuration, things like that. It changed how web frameworks were released. There was MVC existed as a concept before.
Yeah, I think all the top-end features of Rails, I don't think any of it was new. I don't know if DHH, David Heinemeier Hansen, created Rails. I don't know if he invented anything, per se, but he put together a lot of great stuff, and it found legs, right?
I mean, Ruby has been around since, what, the 90s?
Yeah.
Maybe longer, but, I mean...
It wasn't really popularized until 2000.
It was relatively popular in Japan.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the creator, Matt's, is Japanese, but you know, until Rails happened, it was not really, no one paid much attention to it, and then like, this is amazing.
Yeah, and but meanwhile, but it was open source, right?
It was.
So that's something I wanted to talk about here. I mean, we do a lot of Ruby and a lot of .NET here at work, Clear Function, and with .NET, like as we mentioned in one of our earlier episodes, if you're writing a C# ASP.NET web app, you're probably using the Microsoft language, you're using a Microsoft web server, you've got IIS running on your Windows server, you're probably running SQL Server, and those are all things that you're going to pay Microsoft for, which it comes with benefits, not saying that it's not worth it for some people, but that's like a whole Microsoft ecosystem, and I mentioned in that podcast that open source web development is its own platform, basically. I mean, you might be running Postgres written in, I don't know, C++ as your database, and Ruby is written mostly in Ruby, but then the really fast parts are optimized in C, and so on for all of your components for your application. So the open source community just has a completely different approach to things. The profit motives are different. The number of people involved and the number of opinions are just way different. Open source governance is a huge can of worms we could probably spend some time on. Mo here has his own somewhat popular open source library on GitHub, and I've made some commits to other people's popular libraries in the process of using them, but I don't have the experience Mo does of being the primary creator and maintainer of something people use on a regular basis. So
yeah, tell us how that works for you.
So my library is a Swift XML parsing library, which sounds, except for the Swift part, horrifically boring, right? Okay. I started it within months after Apple announced Swift.
Okay.
And I really was using it as an example, as a way to learn Swift. I was working on an iOS app that the company I had worked on had contracted out to someone else to build because we didn't have anyone who was experts in Objective-C at the time or had the time to work on it. Weren't able to work with them at the time, and I thought to myself, I'm going to rewrite it in Swift. And so I was learning Swift as I was going along, and lo and behold, this app was talking to some of our SOAP APIs. And if you've worked with SOAP before, you know that it's a mess of XML.
Right.
And so I was like, well, this is terrible. And I started using the built-in XML parsing library. And it was terrible. It's NSXML parser. It comes with Cocoa. And so I wrote up just little helper things around it. Like, you know what? I'm going to put this out on GitHub.
Yeah.
There was no attention to it for months. And, you know,
because you were the only person in Swiftland dumb enough to touch XML for 6 months. Or?
Well, it was there was a couple others that popped up. Yeah. And the thing is, so it's like getting into open source, though. You just sort of get out there and just push to GitHub and just sort of see what happens.
What's the name of your project?
It's SWXML hash. And by the way, naming is really hard. It's a terrible name. But
I was just wondering. So how does anybody ever find it? Yeah, I was wondering. Like, was your readme just so awesome that SEO for like Swift XML, you're like number one?
Well, I called it. I don't even know if it was number one, but there was as Swift became more popular, people then would build like directories for projects to help out.
Did you submit yourself to all the link farms?
I submitted myself to a few. Like, hey, Swift, here's one right here. Tag with XML. And, I mean, it's got over 500 stars now, and there's a few thousand plus apps based on metrics alone. I have no idea
of any of those. I have a question. Yes. Can you put an Amazon affiliate link to a book on Swift on your readme? Would that work?
I have no idea. But, I mean, the thing is now, all the library really does is it's really, really simple, and it's just sort of
a bunch of convenience wrapper.
It's convenience wrapper methods, basically.
Yeah, anybody who has to touch XML and Swift is not going to want to do the work you've already done.
Right, right.
Like XML is just a means for conveying data from one system to another. Yeah. People have those needs, and you've done the plumbing. And
right. So, and so one of the things that's interesting, though, is after, we'll say 6 months, I've got maybe the first issue reported.
Right.
And I'm like, whoa, what do I do? I don't know what's going on. It was basically a bug report. And I'm like, well, sure, I'd love to help. And then a few more come in. And I start recognizing names. And there's like a small little community that sort of builds up around it where people are not only asking for help, but also responding to issues before I ever get around to them.
Oh.
And
so you submitted, someone submits a bug to your project. You ignore it because you're doing day job, family stuff.
Yeah, I can only work on it at night if I have the free time.
But then somebody else jumps in and helps to resolve the issue. So there's two people who aren't you who are having this whole experience fixing your library's deficiencies.
That was sort of the next step. And most recently, this was the thing that sort of boggled my mind was, we'll say, going from Swift 0. Well, basically, I'm using semantic versioning. Okay. Side note, semantic versioning is when you change the major version, so 1 to 2, you can have breaking changes. Otherwise, you change the minor.
So this is this, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like this is more popular in open source where you're going to see 500 releases of a particular library in a year because people find typos and whatnot.
It's sort of a safety net to say if I upgrade from a minor release to a minor release, I shouldn't have to change anything on my side.
Right.
Anyway, so I just posted an issue and said, what are people's thoughts? I'm about to have to go 1.0. And I'd like to not change from 1 to 2 without doing anything drastic. And I was just, give me some ideas here because I'm noticing people are using it.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said, it'd be really cool if you could have like automatic deserialization. So instead of having to parse all of this stuff by name, I'm like, that sounds like a really great idea. And I don't have the slightest idea how to do that. It would take me a good amount of time. Year later. I mean, literally a year later, someone sends me a pull request with the feature.
Did you accept it?
I did.
Was there a lot of back and
forth?
That's
terrifying.
Or was it like perfect?
I did.
Do you think they went off into a cave for a whole year and worked on this?
No, they didn't go that long. But
I mean, was it the same person?
No, it was someone else.
Interesting. So someone else was like, that is a good idea.
And it's one of those things. That's one of those fascinating things about working in open source is, and getting into a community,
right?
A language community of which I had no experience in before. It's just,
so did they tell you were working on it or did it just come in?
That was one of those things where you can, so with GitHub, you can go and look and see forks, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see who has forked your library. Okay. And so I've looked at that a few times. It's like, well, I actually recognize a name or something, like an organization or something.
It wasn't me.
No. But without actually going and following those things, you don't necessarily see what they're doing.
So they didn't contact you? Because I was going to ask they didn't about reach that. Out. Like, one of the good things about certain open source is if you had been working on it like day in, day out,
right,
you could have undone a lot of work. That you could have had massive merge conflicts of either just. And what if you just decided to say, as the curator of it, you know, you could have been like, that's not the vision of this project.
Which,
oh, man.
Reject. Like, into sort of, like, you had a great experience. It was a feature that you thought was cool. You didn't want to do it.
Absolutely.
So this guy did great for this particular project. But that's one of the problems with open source is different people, and different people don't, you know, there's no rules about how any open source projects really work. And so I've seen some, you know, people have blogged about issues like that where they're like, they get constant pull requests for things that this project's never going to do. They don't care to do it that way, or it's code that's just unmaintainable, or, you know, because there's some things you can help out with back and forth.
Interesting
that he didn't contact you at all for such a...
Two things I want to respond with that. One is, for my own stuff, I have started, even though it's on my repo and I want everyone to send pull requests to me, I've started using pull requests for my own things, so that other people can look and see as
well. Yeah, that makes sense.
So that my code is actually out there.
Do you open them like as soon as you start coding on it then?
I try to.
Interesting.
But that way, because what has happened in the past, and this it wasn't a lot of work, but Swift is about to be on version 3.
Okay.
And they're starting to follow semantic versioning. But from Swift 1... to 1.1 to 1.2, those were all breaking changes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I had to go and bump my version from 1 to 1.2.
That's fascinating.
Because and it was like, all I did was change the version of Swift I was targeting.
Yeah.
But it suddenly broke because, well, anyone who's using this also has to be using the new version of Swift.
Changes.
Yeah. And
so they weren't like little things either. I mean, they're still designing the language.
Absolutely.
At that point. Like 2.0
is
really the first 1.0.
So do you guys have theories about why they would have avoided? Is it because they're trying to avoid the perception of version inflation? Like, if they respected
that's a good
Simba,
question.
Would they be on version 7 right now, the 2-year-old language, and that's embarrassing?
Well, I think it was that when they gave the first version, they called it 1.0.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, really, like Jesse said, 2.0 is the first version. Was 2.0 when they went open source as well? I think it was.
Yeah, I think so.
Before that, if I had been Swift, I would have called it 0.0.
Yeah, right, me too. Yeah, that was my thing.
Yeah, that's like the 5-year Google beta of a new product.
That's right.
But 0 is also embarrassing for a company, right? Because it's not like Apple was like, hey, we made this cool language, maybe you should use it.
Yeah,
They're like, Swift is here to stay.
Yeah, man.
It's time to get on board.
They
couldn't do that with a 0.1.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have, even though you had all the growing pains and everyone else who did any Swift before 2.0. And even 2 to 3, I believe, has some pretty big changes.
It's drastic there too.
Well.
But that's also the one that also runs on Linux. Mm-hmm. I have had some. There's one contributor now who has far more both CI experience, continuous integration, and Linux experience than me.
Right.
And so he actually got me set up with a Travis Matrix build, so that it can run through all of the different build types.
Oh, nice.
And on Linux. And I'm like,
on the different architecture.
It's amazing. I mean, could I have figured it out? Yeah. But would I have found the time to do it where I could help other people? No.
So you're saying that your library runs on 12 different architectures and different device types, and somebody sends you a pull request, and Travis will tell you,
this doesn't work,
and this version of Linux or this version of iOS.
Yeah. So the app that I originally wrote it for never was released because a company came in and acquired us.
Yeah.
And then it was sort of discontinued.
So what does that say about Swift?
Well, it says, that is one. Let me jump back to that question real fast.
That was mostly a joke.
My library targets iOS, macOS, tvOS, watchOS, and Linux now. So there's five different platforms that it can run on. Thankfully, it mostly just works.
Aren't most of those Apple OSs all a flavor of BSD?
They are, But one of the things that happens is when you're using some of the frameworks.
Oh. That, so like, Apple's got 10,000 different APIs and a like, subset well, of them yeah, exist.
Well, yeah, more like two, really. Because like watchOS, tvOS, and iOS are all very similar.
Okay. So it's mobile.
macOS is older. It has ties to a lot older systems yeah, and okay. everything. It's, so the XML underlying APIs that you're wrapping are different between them slightly, right? Is that sort of the...
They're source compatible. Like, I haven't had to change any code. The Linux side currently, it actually has a bug because it turns out, hey, we're on open source podcast right now. Swift is open source, and so I can actually track the progress of a bug in Swift right now Sweet. With the XML parsing bug, yeah. in their public Jira instance.
All right.
So anyway, so you were asking about Swift and the popularity. I don't know if that's exactly what you said. One of the reasons that it's like I said, library has over 500 stars.
Wow.
If it had been in some other language, though, there wouldn't have been as many.
Oh, yeah. You're definitely riding the wave. Like Apple.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jesse, you were probably paying the most attention when Swift came out. Did they not announce it at one of their week-long $1,000 developer conferences? Like, check it out, new language. It's new hotness for iOS. WWDC.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it leaked before WWDC that it was coming out. But, yeah. But I believe they officially announced it at the WWDC. Yeah.
But so, I mean, like, you've got the combined weight of an entire internet full of Apple hype on this new language.
To give you an idea.
For good reason, of course. So just to say, Apple desperately needed a new language, I think,
right?
for this generation of developers. Because Objective-C does a lot of things really well. But what it doesn't do well is readability for a lot of people. And just like... It's just so different than every other language that a lot of people have a hard time jumping in and out of it. So
that's the same lament you hear for any functional language.
To give you an idea, though, like a popular Swift open source library is going to have 10,000 stars.
Whoa.
I mean, it's like, wait, what? And it's just because, I mean, you can look and see how many app store developers there are out there.
That's because XML is just not as popular.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, my first recommendation, you should use JSON instead. But, I mean, I wrote it because it was a pain.
Yeah,
so. I mean,
you needed it done, right? Somebody had money to spend to integrate with an XML
Absolutely,
library.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you like to eat, right? So now there's a thing. Good job open sourcing it.
Anyway, but it has been an interesting experience, and, I mean, it's helping people out. And
you mentioned it earlier a little bit, like, we talked about the businesses and like how people are kind of building up businesses around open source. And that's sort of relatively new to people. You know, you've got people who are building, you've got Unreal. I mean, we talked about Unreal a little bit, like that's sort of the same thing where like you're building off of an open source thing and then you go sell it or whatever. But then there's also just using an open source thing. You've got, you know, but I guess there's just like CMSs, open source CMSs that you can just, that their business is built around just hosting them.
Yes.
So like they don't actually necessarily contribute to the project, or maybe they do a little bit, but like they're not the maintainers of that project. They're just people who sell support for that project.
That is and a
like,
really interesting one. I've seen rants about that sort of thing. Like say one person or group of people spends years of their lives building this great product. The internet loves it. Somebody else makes $1 million off of it. And meanwhile, that person is still just maybe hoping to find a job at one of those
million-dollar
companies.
I mean, Red Hat has, you can have, that's basically the one that has commercial support for it.
Right.
You can get Red Hat Linux without that, but if you want the support, I mean, that's always been the example I've heard of.
They're sort of the curators, though. Like, they are, actually do quite a bit of work on it, I guess. Yeah. I feel different about Red Hat versus like someone who, like you said, builds on top of some like open source CMS for like, you know, years and years, and then suddenly they just come in and they're like, you know what, we're going to make a Bootstrap page around this, and we're just going to sell support, and I'm just going to go to AWS and deploy it.
Yeah.
And because that's where my expertise, now it doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to make money off of it, but it is sort of an interesting rift for certain projects because, you know, most people are not getting paid to actually create these open source projects or maintain them in any way.
Yeah, it feels like a kind of arbitrage. Maybe somebody devotes a lot of attention and energy to making an almost viable open source product that has characteristics that are useful, but maybe they don't know the right market niche, or they just don't do the work to make it into a product.
Or they didn't even think about it, right? They made it for their own use, and then suddenly they're like, oh man, this guy's like selling my product.
You know? I mean, okay, let's take an example that I use and like, and this is in no way a slight, but let's say Postgres. It's this huge database. I'm sure big companies are paying people to work on it as developers, but I use Postgres in its free incarnation on virtual private servers like DigitalOcean droplets or EC2 boxes. But say Heroku is one of my favorite places to deploy a Rails app. And a couple years ago, Heroku opened their own Postgres service, and it does a lot of the things that you'd like to have done for any production database. You've got backups, you've got forking, you can have follower databases where you can have live streaming backups, that sort of thing.
Right.
And their entry-level price plan is something like $50 a month for a database that's not particularly big.
Yeah, they're standard. Their hobby is actually cheaper.
Yeah.
But,
and
yeah.
Heroku, I think you can get away. You can get a web application running for half that or less per month for Heroku. I can pay $6 a month on DigitalOcean to run my own Rails app, my own database, etc. But from a business perspective, you stop and think about how much do any of your developers really know about being DBAs?
Right.
Do you want to hire a full-time DBA to do 10 hours a month of database work? Do you want your developers to spend 20 hours doing it poorly? I mean, there's lots of ways to go. And so for a profitable business, dropping $50 or $100 or $200 a month on their database is a no-brainer. But Heroku is keeping all of that money. And I'm sure they are reinvesting in Postgres and Rails and the ecosystem. I think they employed Mats at one point, creator of Ruby.
I think he's still there.
Okay, so yeah, Heroku is... In no way do I feel that Heroku is a bad citizen in the open source community, but that's just an example of...
But you don't. They're not required to be. They're just they're just being a good citizen because they you know, I guess they feel the need to do that. Or but there's a lot of places that just don't do that.
Sure.
You know,
and for them, they employ a lot of high-profile developers, and they sell to developers. So it's really it's a good synergy in their market. Like, they're good citizens. They do things that developers want. I mean, you could talk about, say, I don't know, APIs, like, say, PayPal API versus Stripe API. Developers love Stripe. It's got great documentation. It takes 5 seconds to set up, and now your website's taking money. And it's very popular because it targeted developers.
Something else, too, I was thinking about is I remember reading a conversation online somewhere. Someone had released some source that they found useful. Someone else forked it, and they weren't making money off of it, but it was sort of more of a, wow, they're getting more publicity, and they didn't actually attribute back.
Ooh.
But the problem is that the license that he chose didn't require attribution.
Oh.
And so,
they did nothing.
It's one of those things where it's like there are ways that you can... GitHub has tried to help out with this. So when you create a new repo now, especially one that is public, they ask, hey, do you want to pick a license? And we'll drop it in there right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the popular ones out there, MIT is like, you know, you can pretty much do whatever you want. But I think it says you just need to refer back to whoever, you know, if you push this out.
You got to keep this license visible for the next person using the code.
But it's not, you know, it's not one of the copy left ones that says you bring this in, then any code that's using it also has to be open.
Yeah.
That, I mean, there's a lot of bigger corporations or even smaller who that's a little scary because they haven't thought through the implications of what that would even mean.
Right.
Maybe they have intellectual property or something that they want to.
There's a lot of weird things that go around specifically with like Swift and iOS, like over the years. And I don't know if it's changed at all recently, but I remember, you know, the copyleft stuff was sort of a problem for like, I seem to remember maybe an audio player of some sort. Like they're like, oh, they released this on the App Store. And I think they had to kind of like take it down because it was end up using an open source library. But you couldn't actually because of the way the linking works in like iOS, like you couldn't actually you couldn't meet the demands of the of the license.
The App Store build and deploy process violated the license's distribution
basically requirements. It's not necessarily the way the build and deploy, but the way you had to kind of package your stuff up
because
like the
it's statically linked. It's like embedded into the binary.
So there's some interesting like things about that I thought like a walled garden like Apple sort of introduced and made open source a little different. Like I think people maybe are writing licenses a little differently these days to you know get around some of those. So it gets interesting.
All right. So I wanted to do a quick sidebar on different rough types of licenses and what they might mean for a business or a project. So either of you have something you want to say about rough categories of licenses?
One thing I will say, I was on a project one time where there was an audit. Basically, we wanted to make sure that we weren't using any licenses that were going to be viral or something like that. And that question has come up a few times because I think the company I was at the time received a cease and desist.
Yeah.
And basically said, and it was, actually the cease and desist was because they thought we were using a commercial product that actually we weren't at the time.
Oh.
So and it was one of those things where it was just, it made me think about like how back working with, we'll say 5-10 years ago with .NET projects, you might just drop it into your source.
Yeah.
And
just
so
copy
it could
and paste
be
the library and you've got a DLL on your production server. Nobody knows.
Yeah. Yeah. But with, at least with .NET now, if you're using NuGet, then you now have a packages config file that actually dictates your external dependencies. In Ruby, you've got a gem file now. And so you can very easily see it gets a little gray and difficult with JavaScript, unless you're using some of the current, you know, tools as far as managing your third-party dependencies.
Is it just me, or does that describe a dependency graph that could be automated? I mean, if every library, if there was a list of, I don't know, the top 50 most popular licenses and some programming done around it, you could spit out an audit automatically, right?
I mean, I was able to give, whenever the audit was requested, just, I did have to do because we still had some JavaScript and it gets weird.
Right.
Like, oh, you're pulling it from a CDN, so it's not referenced anywhere except, you know.
Yeah.
And even then, you're not hosting it. I don't know what, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what happens then.
No, Mo, you mentioned copyleft earlier, and that's what got me curious about categories of licenses. I guess I'll take that one a bit. Just had a question come in earlier about different types of licenses, like what does the MIT license mean? And so the way I understand it, I haven't gone so far as last week's guest, Brad, and read a whole book on open source licenses and their implications, but MIT is basically, you can do whatever you want with this, but maintain attributions back to the author, and probably the license has to go with the code. Whereas others, like copyleft, as you guys mentioned, things like the GPL, which I don't know if he wrote it, but certainly Richard Stallman has been a driving force behind that for decades. That is designed as sort of a global vision of uncopyright, or not uncopyrightable, but unownable software. Like, it is purposely written to be given out to the whole world where anyone can use it, but no one can then pull a Slugworth and take it in and wrap it up and make all their own money off of it and not tell anybody. Like, there's viral licenses that are designed to where if you commit to using it, you basically categorically open up your whole business to being free, and you know, there's no hiding of things. You're just now a public business that isn't selling software in certain situations. So that's GPL v3 is one of those viral licenses, and I think the Affero, the AGPL you mentioned earlier,
right
BSD license, I think, is also similar to MIT, and that people use it often for libraries. That seems to be the sweet spot. You write code you want other people to use.
Right.
You're not selling it, but you still want to maintain some rights to it. That's where apparently MIT and BSD come in. And then others I've seen for more public domain software, like systems and applications, like, let's say, I don't know, a clone of Microsoft Office or Linux or a web server. Then you'd see things like Apache license or regular GPL. Like, this is definitely public domain, but it's not really a component.
Yeah, the AGPL, I don't actually know how old it is, but it seems like that's come up more frequently when a company wants to build a business around something and they want to embrace open source, but it's almost like building the support aspect into it.
Right.
I know there's a lot of people who don't really like that idea.
I don't know though. Yeah. Like, I like that idea for, like, Postgres is a perfect example of, like, I'm really glad that Postgres is an open source database engine that people way smarter than me contribute to it on, like, a daily basis.
Right.
But I really love that people like Heroku and the Droplet people have kind of stepped in to make my life easier as a developer, because I'm not developing database software.
Right, right.
I'm using database as a service. And so I'm really glad that, you know, someone steps in to do that side of it, because most developers don't have the experience to make that. You know, they can make really awesome software, but they don't really make it so that it's just, you know, super easy to use in every scenario. And so, so, you know, I think there's the, you know, the short of it is, I think there's a reason to do each of those licenses. Right. They exist for a reason. There's not just one right license. GPL these days, the V3 stuff seems a little, it's a little restrictive to me. Like, I love open source software, but, like, every time I see that license, it's always like, oh man, I have to think really hard about it.
Yeah.
It pretty much has to be, you have to have already going in being like, this is going to be open source. And it feels like to me personally, a lot of times I'm like, well, it just seems a little aggressive. Like, I like building off the shoulders of everyone. I love attributing my work on other people, but I don't necessarily want to be like kind of backed into that corner. But that's why there's other licenses.
So. Yeah, and I'd say Stallman and the Free Software Foundation in general have been purposefully futuristic idealists. Like, they're looking out decades in the future, trying to imagine what's the logical conclusion of everyone in the world running closed source Windows. And I mean, there's Stallman's written some really interesting and influential essays. Like, there's one called The Right to Read, written 20 years ago, and it basically forecast things like having a Kindle and getting to pay fees to read a textbook and having it rejected and having it taken back and whatnot. And it all just seems super outlandish. But now students will pay $100 every semester to get a password to log into a website for access to a PDF textbook that then gets yanked every semester. And I've spent, I don't know how much money on Kindle books for Amazon. And I know that there's implications there that are kind of uncomfortable. I mean, not only can people subpoena Amazon and see my reading habits, but also if I cross some invisible line and offend Amazon, I could lose access to my back catalog of hundreds or thousands of dollars I've spent on digital media. So that type of thing, Stallman is out there looking out for you, even though he's not necessarily the most charismatic figure, right? But it's good to have people out there.
I can see that as like a future thing that definitely makes a lot more sense. But like as a developer, like, you know, not everything I can do is open source.
Right. But all three of us here in this room are developers and we program for money, but we also do it for fun.
Yeah.
Right.
So there are people out there maybe who would love to figure out a way to take something like Heroku and take ownership of it and sell it for $1 billion. And that's not quite what Heroku is doing. But, you know, you can imagine that other people would see this as an opportunity that exists just to be exploited for their personal gain.
Exactly.
So that's why the community protects itself when it does.
Yeah.
If you guys or all of us could go through a little bit about open source, how it relates to work, any kind of advice. I mean, I'll say as a developer, I've learned the most about programming by going out and reading popular open source code. Like, if I want to know how something interesting is done in Rails, I go on GitHub, I look up the Rails repo, I find it. I learn a lot about how Rails works, but also good software design.
Absolutely.
World-class software design and how other people's styles shake out. One thing that's been really neat for me recently is the Go programming language. It was originally billed as a systems programming language. They've kind of backed off from that. Now it's more concurrent internet-enabled applications. But there's a lot of low-level software that's implemented in Go right now, which is fun for me because Go has a strong cultural emphasis on simplicity and readability. And that's to serve certain ends at Google. You know, they want to be able to hire a 22-year-old with a degree from a top 10 CS school and slot them in and have them be able to be productive in a week. But now I can go and see how a database engine is implemented in Go and read it and understand it. And I'm not sure if I wanted to go get the Postgres source and figure out how the most complicated parts were done. I would have to spend weeks learning how that flavor of C or C++ or whatever is done before I could even start digging into the meat of how the database works, right? So with something like Go, I can get out there and read open source databases and suddenly learn things in a short period of time. So I love that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in the .NET world, and you should definitely take the time to seek that out. Maybe your only real exposure to open source from a .NET shop might just be a couple of NuGet packages or some jQuery, but that stuff's out there. Go read it.
Yeah. I would recommend for just getting involved in some of it, go ahead and create a GitHub repo.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't have any ideas for pushing something out there. Maybe find a library you like and look. So I'm more talking about actually contributing back, but there's services and websites out there, or you can look at the issue list and you might see a tag like help wanted.
Right.
That's a really, really nice way to sort of get involved. And like Daniel was saying, GitHub in general, and just some of this, the more easy to use open source hosting platforms like that have really helped learning in general.
Right.
Where you can just go and you can just read source easily. And they've made the navigation tools such that you don't necessarily have to clone down, you know, like Linux source, for example. You don't have to pull down the source, which will take forever because, I mean, it's got a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
and a lot of code too. You can just sort of browse and learn through some of that stuff now.
Yeah, the teaching and learning in looking through this history of a repo is just amazing. We had a Ruby user group a couple of years ago. I was here in at this office, actually. I was working with the Spree e-commerce system heavily at the time, and there's one module that I used for sort of an impromptu presentation where it was a major refactoring had happened, where basically this software had kind of grown out organically, and all this logic that was related had been found in 20 different places. And one person, who was Spree's amazing community manager, who's a great programmer, he took that and he built it into a specific, he implemented some pattern, and he put it all in one file, one class, and suddenly it makes sense. And you can look on GitHub and see the specific commit that landed into Spree on that day, see what it looked like before, see what it looked like after, see what the notes were, how he explained it to the community. Hey, I just moved your cheese. You're going to like it. Here's why.
Right.
And then you can follow the slow growth of that file over time. It's just a really amazing way to learn something that you won't necessarily see in a small-scale, single-purpose project, like internal applications. Mm-hmm. They're just different levels of sophistication and breadth of needs. It's a great learning opportunity.
Yeah, I think we'll probably have to have another episode on more open source, like maybe, you know, targeting like how to be a good community curator, either at, you know, how to curate a project or how to commit to a project, you know, because I think there's probably a lot of stuff about, you know, how not to step on the project lead's toes or the contributors and how to contribute even if you've never contributed before. So I think there's a lot more to do there, but I think that should wrap up everything for today.
All right.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks, Mo.
Thank you.
We'll see you guys next time.
You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by Clear Function. Clear Function is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.